Okay, thanks. I'd like to start by thanking the organizers and in particular Beth for inviting me to talk about this work. And this was done in collaboration with Zhengxing Chen and Aram Harrow. So at the moment, both at the University of Bristol. Zhengxing is visiting us there for an extended visit, and otherwise he's at the Tsinghua University in Beijing. So Graham has already shown us this picture of channel, the picture that associated with channel capacities. And all I want to add to what Graham said is to emphasize the fact that in the capacity problem, we're encoding information, sending it over many copies of the channel, and decoding it to recover that information. And in the normal definition of capacities, we require that the error, the probability of error in that recovery operation should tend to zero asymptotically in the limit of many copies of the channel. So zero error capacities are defined very similarly. The only difference is that now we require a slightly stricter requirement on that probability of error in recovering the information. And we require that error should be strictly equal to zero rather than asymptotically tending to zero. Okay, so zero error capacities were first studied by guess who? Claude Shannon in a paper in 1956. And why are people interested in zero error capacities? Well, I guess the most compelling reason is that if we have only a finite number, a restricted number of uses of the channel available to us, then the asymptotics in that error probability in the normal capacity may not kick in. And if that's the case, then we may try and communicate at the Shannon capacity, but we'll end up with very large errors because we're not in the asymptotic regime. And in that case, if we communicate at the Shannon capacity but with an error probability that's 90%, it's obviously completely useless in practice. So people are interested, I guess, in zero error capacities from a practical point of view, because it's for the case of when we have a limited number of uses of the channel, because in that context, the zero error scenario setting is more relevant. Because we really require the error to be equal to zero even with a limited number of uses. Okay, so that's why people are interested in them. Just to give you a flavor of this, here's the simplest non-trivial example of a noisy channel that has some zero error capacity. This is a channel that has 5 inputs, 5 outputs. It's just a classical channel for now. And it maps the zero, for example, the zero input is mapped to either 0 or 1 with some probabilities. And it's clear how we can send a bit of information through this noisy channel with zero error. We could, for example, encode the information into the 0 and 2 inputs. Those are going to map to be outputs that have no overlap, so we can perfectly distinguish what the input was on the output side, and so we can recover the bit perfectly. And we can look at that in another way, which isn't going to be important for this talk, but just for a bit of background, we can draw a kind of adjacency graph of this channel by identifying vertices with inputs and edges with outputs. And in looking at that adjacency graph, we can see that we can communicate with zero error through this channel, with just one copy of the channel I'm talking about for a moment, by the fact that there are two vertices that are not adjacent to each other in this graph. Okay, so in fact, much of modern graph theory was originally motivated by studying zero error capacities, and really a lot of research in graph theory, you can trace its roots back to studying this problem. Okay, so Graham also showed us this table of the status of Shannon capacity theory, so both in classical and the quantum setting. And the only thing I want to add to what Graham said is to emphasize his own result, this superactivation result. So superactivation, which is what I'm going to talk about in this talk, is the property of having two channels that are completely useless, even when we have infinitely many copies of them, but put those two different channels together and suddenly they become useful. So for classical channels, it's trivial to see that this can't happen. In fact, it's an easy consequence of the fact that there's additivity. For the classical information over quantum channels, it's actually also trivial to see that this can't take place. Even though they may or may not be, the capacity may or may not be non-additive, superactivation is impossible, even for quantum channels, when we try and put classical information through them. And what Graham Smith and John Yard showed last year is that if you try and put quantum information over quantum channels, this superactivation can occur. Because this superactivation is a very strange thing. It's like having two blocked pipes, and you unblock them just by putting water down both pipes at the same time. So here's the same table, but for zero error capacities. And zero error capacities, you'll see that even classically, we don't have a single letter formula. We need the regularization. That's already known from a long time ago. And that additivity is also violated for the zero error capacities for classical channels. In fact, an example for both of those things is the pentagon channel that I showed you before on the previous slide. But again, classically, it's very easy to see that superactivation cannot occur classically. So what I'm going to show in this talk is that if we try and send classical information over a quantum channel in a zero error setting, we do get superactivation. I should mention that there were two papers posted on the archive simultaneously, and Runyal Dwan also posted similar results to this. For the classical capacity, his results are strictly weaker than what we've shown and are a consequence of our results. But Runyal also considered the quantum zero-error capacity, about which we don't say anything. I won't have time to do justice to Runyal's results in this talk, but they're definitely, you should look at those as well. So here's what I'm going to prove. Just stated carefully. I will show that there exist pairs of channels, E1 and E2, that individually, so here we're in the setting of quantum channels, so these are CPT maps. The pairs of channels that individually have no zero error capacity, even when we have infinitely many copies of the channels. But when we put these two channels together, they will have some zero error capacity. So I guess I'll save that. So at this point, I should probably ask if there are any questions about what I'm talking about and the scenario, because from now on, I'm going to talk about the proofs, and you'll probably fall asleep. I'll wake you up again at the end. Everything's clear, I guess, so far. Okay, so the remainder of the talk, I'm going to try and give you a sketch of the proof. I certainly won't have time to go through everything in detail. So here's what we're after. We want two channels that have individually zero error capacity, and the joint channel should have non-zero zero error capacity. So the first thing we need to do is to get a handle on when does the channel have some zero error capacity, and when is the zero error capacity zero. And if we just think about one copy of the channel rather than the asymptotic limit for a moment, so we'll call this the one-shot zero error capacity. It's quite easy to see when this is non-zero. It's non-zero if and only if we can put two different inputs into the channel, and the outputs are perfectly distinguishable, just as we saw in the case of classical channels earlier with the pentagon channel. And I can write that down. So we're just saying that the zero error capacity for a single copy of the channel is non-zero, if and only if there are two inputs whose outputs are perfectly distinguishable. In other words, they're orthogonal, right? Because quantum states are distinguishable perfectly if and only if they're orthogonal. I'll write down the converse because I will need both these. So conversely, the one-shot zero error capacity is zero if and only if every pair of states maps to outputs that are not orthogonal. Okay, so now we can I want to play a small trick on these expressions. I'm just going to pull the channel here over the other side of the inner product and rewrite it in terms of the dual. So I'm writing the same expression now in terms of the dual of the channel, which we've seen yesterday and the day before, and composed with the channel, the CPT map itself. And then I rewrite my conditions on the channels in terms of just rewriting those expressions. So I want two channels such that individually their capacities are zero, and together the capacities are non-zero. Okay, so far I've been talking about one-shot capacity, so I've just talked about restricted the case of a single copy of the channel, but of course what we're really interested in is asymptotic capacities, regularized versions where we've got arbitrarily many uses of the channel. And for that, well, it's rather easy. Again, I just need that even if I take tensor powers of the channel, I want the capacity to be zero. That just means that for every tensor power of the channel, it should still hold that the zero error capacity is zero. So putting that into my requirements, I just have to add a tensor power here, and there should be a for all k sitting here as well, which is missing. So that's what we're looking for mathematically. And just to simplify the notation a bit, I'm going to call this map, this composite map of the channel, the CPT map composed with its dual, I'm going to call this n. Okay, it's not, since the dual is not necessarily completely positive and trace preserving, this map here, composite map, is not necessarily completely positive and trace preserving, but it's a map nonetheless. And right, but not trace preserving. Since it's a linear map, I can rewrite these expressions in terms of the Choi matrices. So let's do that. It's a fair few lines of very simple manipulations to get to this point. So rephrasing my requirements in terms of Choi matrices, I want two Choi matrices for these composite maps, so for this n, such that the conditions I wrote down before hold, or the translation of those into the Choi matrix language. Okay, so at the moment, I've still got some freedom here in the second condition, which was for the joint channel. I just need that there exist a pair of inputs that give me orthogonal outputs. And so I'm now going to just fix what those inputs are going to be. I'm going to choose, since we know somehow that entanglement is going to play a role here, because it's clear that we're never going to get superactivation with separable inputs. So let's just say, well, let's look for the thing this to work when we put the maximally entangled state into this pair of channels. Seems like a sensible thing to do. So I'm going to choose the two inputs to be the standard maximally entangled state, and then just a local unitary rotation of that maximally entangled state. And why do I do this? Well, because choosing those particular states, apart from the fact that intuitively it makes sense, it also simplifies this expression, this my second condition, into this form. Again, that's some trivial manipulations inside the trace. Okay, so why have I done all of this? I've done this because now, well, what do these expressions say? They actually say something rather nice. Let's look at this expression. It says that for all inputs, for all pairs of states, the product state should always have any product state should have overlap with the Choi matrix. In other words, that the orthogonal complement of the support of the Choi matrix should contain no product states. That's simply saying in words what this equation is telling us. And on the other hand, this second condition here is telling us also something rather simple. It's saying that this Choi matrix and this matrix here, their inner product should be zero. In other words, they should have orthogonal support up to transposes in these unitary rotations. So there probably should be a transpose here, but it's not too crucial. So in fact, these two conditions are now telling us something about the supports of the Choi matrices, and we don't care about anything other than the support of the Choi matrix. So now let's rephrase these conditions in terms of the supports instead. So we want two bipartite subspaces supporting these Choi matrices, such that there are no product states in the orthogonal complement of the subspaces, or even any of their tensor powers, and that these subspaces are orthogonal up to these local unitaries, which I can fix later. And I'm going to simplify things even more, because if we're going to pick subspaces whose orthogonal complements contain no product states, it seems sensible to make those orthogonal complements as small as possible. In other words, we want to make the subspaces as big as possible. So I'm going to make the subspaces, these two subspaces, as big as possible subject to this second constraint. In other words, I'm going to really choose the subspaces to be orthogonal complements of each other up to these local unitaries. And if I do that, I've reduced my requirements to this. I simply need a bipartite subspace which can support these Choi matrices in this way, which I'll talk about in a moment. I want a bipartite subspace whose orthogonal complement contains no product states and whose subspace itself should contain no product states. So this more or less says that the subspace should contain no product states. If we took the k equals 1 case, it would. And this says that the orthogonal complement of the subspace contains no product states. And I also want this to hold for tensor powers of that subspace. Okay, so now I need to worry about... I've rephrased everything in terms of these subspaces, but I've got this constraint here that the subspace must be able to construct a Choi matrix supported on that subspace of these maps that have this rather special form of being the composition of a CPT map and its dual. So I need to know what constraints that imposes on my subspaces. And, well, that's the content of this theorem. It basically gives a complete characterization of the subspaces that admit such Choi matrices supported on them. So the two conditions boil down to, firstly, a symmetry constraint. So this flip operation here, I need to define it, because this is simply taking, remember, I have a bipartite subspace. So it takes a bipartite state, it flips the two subsystems, and it takes the complex conjugate. So I know that used often in operator theory language, flip is what quantum information theorists call swap. So this is swap plus complex conjugation in a fixed product basis, which I have to fix. Okay, so this subspace needs to be closed under this flip operation. Okay, so it needs to have this flip symmetry. The second condition is slightly stranger. I can always consider my bipartite subspace as a matrix space in the following way. Well, I just write down the states in a particular product basis, and I just consider instead the space of the coefficient matrices in this product basis. So bipartite subspace is the same thing as a matrix space. And if I think about this subspace as a bipartite subspace as a matrix space, this is requiring that there should be a basis of matrices for this subspace, not necessarily an orthogonal basis, but there should be a basis that's positive semi-definite. Okay, the fact that there's a basis that permission is imposed by this condition, because in terms of viewing these subspaces as a matrix space, this flip symmetry just corresponds to the fact that the matrix space should be closed under Hermitian conjugation. So this additionally imposes that I need a basis that's positive semi-definite. Okay, it's a slightly odd constraint, but this is necessary and sufficient. So this is what drops out. Okay, so now I have my requirements on my subspace, and now I can get rid of all of this stuff about them supporting Choi matrices, and I've re-expressed that simply in terms of constraints on the subspace. So I now have these, well, three pairs of constraints, which are basically constraints on the subspace and its orthogonal complement, the two subspaces that are going to support the Choi matrices of my two channels. So these are about the orthogonal complements containing no product states, these are about the flip symmetry, and these are about this slightly odd condition that there should be a positive semi-definite basis. Okay. I now need to, prove that there are subspaces that satisfy all of these constraints simultaneously, and then I'm done. So to do that, I need to turn to algebraic geometry, and I'll need to use a certain small amount of terminology here, which I'm going to abuse somewhat. But for our purposes, I'll need to talk about Zariski closed sets. Well, a Zariski closed set, for our purposes, is nothing other than a set that's defined by a collection of simultaneous polynomial equations. Okay. So, for example, a circle is a Zariski closed set because it's defined by some polynomial, it's the set of solutions to some polynomial equations. Subspaces are Zariski closed, etc. Since I'm talking about subspaces, it's not surprising that I'll have to talk about Grassmannians. So the Grassmannian of a vector space V is simply the space of all d-dimensional subspaces of that vector space. Okay. And the other two, I will mention them, but it's not so crucial to understand what those are. Okay, so here are my I want to find subspaces satisfying these conditions. So, firstly, I'm going to concentrate just on the first one. I want a subspace whose orthogonal complement contains no product states, and that should also hold for tensor powers. So how can I prove that the subspaces like this exist? Well, firstly, I'm going to define the set of subspaces I don't want. Okay, so this looks very complicated, but it's saying something rather simple. This is just the set of subspaces, which of course live in the Grassmannian. It's the set of subspaces such that their orthogonal complements contain no product states for a specific tensor power of the subspace, K. And then E sub D is just the union over all of those subspaces. Okay, so this is, what is this? This is the set of subspaces, of all the subspaces that have a tensor power whose orthogonal complement does contain a product state. In other words, it's the set of subspaces we don't want. Those are the things we don't want, like. We want exactly the complement of this. And the key observation is that this set is Zariski closed, right? So it's defined by a set of polynomial constraints. I'm not going to give you the proof of that, but I'm going to give you some intuition about why that's not such an unreasonable thing to believe. So as before, I can think of states in a bipartite space as being a matrix, as being matrices. Okay, I guess I should have said don't worry, these are unnormalized states, and then I correspond to a space of matrices. And so what are product states? Well, in terms of these matrices, these are just rank 1 matrices, okay? This is exactly how we get the Schmidt decomposition, or rather the singular value decomposition, and the rank of this matrix is exactly the Schmidt rank of this state. So product states are rank 1 matrices. And what's a rank 1 matrix? Well, it's a matrix whose order 2 minors vanish. So in other words, all of the 2 by 2 subdeterminants of this matrix, take the 2 by 2 submatrices, take their determinant, they should all be 0. Okay, if you're not familiar with that fact, it's in Horn and Johnson chapter 0, for example. It's really in chapter 0. So we have the product states are characterized by a set of simultaneous polynomials, these order 2 minors. And so we have a set characterized by polynomial equations. So it's not so unreasonable to believe that we can lift that up to this set E sub D, which was defined in terms of containing product states, and that we can actually show that subset of subspaces is characterized by polynomial equations. And for those of you who know this, this is just a particular instance of something called the Segre variety. For those who don't, it's not important. Okay, here's a fact about Zariski closed sets. They're either measure 0 in the sense of the usual measure, so here we're talking about subspaces, so we can take the Haar measure, or they're the entire space. So why is that? That fact is rather intuitively obvious. We've got a set characterized by some algebraic constraints. Well, either these constraints are trivial, in which case that set is in fact the full space, or those constraints are non-trivial. If they're non-trivial, then they must restrict that set to some lower dimensional manifold, which makes it measure zero in the full space. Okay, so this fact is intuitively clear. The algebraic geometry makes it rigorous. So remember that ED is the set of things I don't want, and I want to show it's measure zero. So how do I do that? Well, there's only two possibilities. It's either measure zero or it's everything. So to show that it's measure zero, I just need to show there's one thing that's not in the set E sub D. And to do that, I can use something called unextendable product basis. So an unextendable product basis is simply a basis of product states to which we can't add another product state orthogonal to it. So it's a basis of product states that contains no other product states in the orthogonal complement. So these have been very well studied in quantum information theory for a variety of reasons. If we take a subspace spanned by a UPB, this is of course exactly the kind of thing we want for this first condition, because it's orthogonal complement will contain no product states. But the nice thing about a UPB is when you tensor up two UPBs, it's still a UPB. Okay, this fact was known for orthogonal UPBs, this was known a while ago. For non-orthogonal UPBs, i.e. where the basis states are not orthogonal, we proved this. We extended the fact to prove that. So a UPB is exactly a subspace whose tensor powers contain no product states in the orthogonal complement. In other words, it's a subspace that lives outside of E sub D. In other words, E sub D cannot be the full space. It has to be measure zero. So if the set of bad subspaces is zero measure, then the set of good ones is full measure, and so we can just pick a subspace at random and it's going to satisfy this condition. So that's the first condition dealt with. What about the second one? Well, we're picking a subspace at random, but that's the same thing as picking its orthogonal complement at random. I have to worry about the dimensions, but that turns out to not be an issue. So if I pick a subspace at random, then the same properties are going to hold for its orthogonal complement. So I get the second condition for free. So now I need to deal with the next couple of conditions, which are about symmetry constraints. So let me just restrict my attention for now to those symmetry constraints. And I'm going to define, well, yet another set of subspaces. These are the set of subspaces that obey the symmetry constraints that I want. Okay, that's what all that notation is just saying. And I guess it's a familiar theme now. Well, this set is also Zariski closed. Okay, the proof of that I'm going to give even less details of, although it's even more plausible, I guess, because this is simply these are simply linear constraints on my subspace. So I just have to do a bit of work to show that this really does, on the sort of a coordinate space of subspaces, this corresponds to a set of algebraic constraints. And this one can just do by a standard method of, you know, mapping those constraints via the Plucker embedding and see that, okay, if you know about that, this is obvious. If you don't, it's quite plausible that some linear constraints here lift to something algebraic on the set of all subspaces. Okay, so this set is also Zariski closed. And now I want to put in these conditions again. So I want to combine the product state conditions with the symmetry conditions. Well, I can just repeat all of my Zariski closure arguments that I used before, but now instead of for the set E sub D, I can take the intersection of E sub D, the guys we don't want, what do they look like inside the space of things that obey the symmetry constraints. And the same arguments go through. The only thing I have to be careful about is that I need to symmetrize this UPB, because in general, a UPB is not going to obey the symmetry constraints, and I want one that's inside the set F sub D. But I can symmetrize the UPB. This will blow up its dimension a little bit, but one can get a handle on how much, in specific cases, it blows up the dimension. And this gives me, if you see, my original theorem had some dimension conditions in there. This is one place the dimension constraints come from. The other place is that UPBs don't exist for all dimensions. Okay, so the same Zariski closure arguments go through for this intersection of E sub D with F sub D in the set F sub D. So I rule out that case. This set of bad subspaces, even in the set of things that have the right symmetry, is still zero measure. So again, choosing one at random subject to the symmetry constraints is going to be good. So I've dealt with these two constraints, and I now have a final pair, which is this constraint that I should have a positive semi-definite basis. And, well, to deal with that, I just claim that the set of subspaces obeying these positivity constraints is finite measure within F sub D, the set that obey the symmetry constraints. Okay? I'm not, at the moment, I'm ignoring my first pair of constraints, the product state constraints for the moment. So I'm just looking at the set of subspaces that obey the positivity constraints within things obeying the symmetry. And how do I show that these are finite measure? Well, again, I'm just going to give a sketch of how this goes to give you some intuition. I start by constructing a basis of a matrix. Again, thinking about these things as matrix spaces. I construct a matrix subspace with the right symmetries, and I make sure that the identity matrix is inside that subspace. And if I have the identity matrix inside my subspace, then if I take any Hermitian basis and just add enough identity to it, I'm going to make that all of the basis elements positive, semi-definite. And then that just shows that there's one subspace that obeys the symmetry and also the positivity conditions. But by perturbation, if I perturb the identity a little bit, it's still going to be full rank and positive. So there's going to be a ball around this particular constructed subspace that will still contain a full rank positive matrix, which I can add to all the basis elements to make the basis positive semi-definite. So like this, I get that there's some finite measure, some finite ball around this particular construction that will obey the constraints. Okay, so what have I done? I've started by showing that these subspaces obeying these constraints actually are, the set is full measure, and it's even full measure if I look at it inside the set obeying of subspaces obeying these symmetries. And now I've shown that these constraints, well, the set obeying these constraints is finite measure within the set of things obeying the symmetries. So that, I mean, if I have a finite measure set from this guy and a full measure set from this guy, so there's got to be some intersection between those two sets that's finite measure. So this means I just pick a subspace at random satisfying these symmetry constraints, and with some finite probability it's going to satisfy all of the other constraints. And that finishes what I've got to say about it. We now unwind everything that I've done. I've just shown that subspace exists with the right properties. I unwind that to construct Choi matrices on them. I unwind the Choi matrices to get my channels, and in that way, if I unwind back through everything, I will have got two channels that give me the superactivation of the zero error capacity. So what can we conclude from this? Well, firstly, I think that the most important consequence of this is the fact that, I mean, Graham and Smith and John Yard showed this remarkable property of quantum channels. That year is wrong. They showed that you can have pairs of quantum channels that have no capacity for quantum information, but put them together and they do. But after that result, one might have said, okay, putting quantum information through channels is a strange thing. You know, we're used to quantum information is always strange. Surely classical information will behave more, will at least not behave in this completely crazy, extreme and non-additive way. And indeed, that intuition is correct for the putting classical information through quantum channels. But it turns out that it's not correct in the zero error setting, which is also a very natural setting that's well studied in classical information theory. So we get this extreme non-additivity even for classical information over quantum channels. And so a more mathematical corollary of this result is that a corollary of this result is that we can, and I guess we'll hear more about this later in Chris King's talk, capacity additivity questions are related to minimum output entropy additivity questions. And a way of stating, well, one part of this result is that we've shown that the regularized Rényi zero entropy is non-additive. In other words, take the minimum output Rényi zero entropy in the asymptotic limit of many copies of the channel divided by the number of channels. Okay, we've shown that this regularized Rényi zero entropy is non-additive. And if we could prove the same thing for the regularized Rényi one entropy, in other words, for the von Neumann entropy, then we would prove the big open question that still remains in normal Shannon theory of quantum channels. In other words, the non-additivity of the Shannon capacity, classical Shannon capacity of quantum channels. Okay, with that, thanks for listening.
Thanks for the talk. Do you have any comments or questions?
Does your approach let you come up with specific examples, or is it again an existence?
Oh, that's a good question. It's an existence proof. If you only care about the one-shot results, right? So here we've shown that really the capacities are non-additive. If you only care about one-shot capacities, then we can give explicit examples. And these explicit examples, of course, they're almost certainly, since it's full measure, everything we want, these examples are almost certainly examples for the asymptotic case. But there's no way of proving that, because it's hard to prove that the capacity is zero. So, no, but sort of. Yeah.
You mentioned in the beginning that there was another fellow
Okay. No, he didn't. I'm glad you asked that, because I didn't have time to say too much about that. What he proved with regard to the classical capacity is two results. One, he proved the one-shot result without using any algebraic geometry. And the reason he couldn't go to the asymptotic case is because he didn't use algebraic geometry. The other result he did prove, though, is that... this is really nice. What he also proved is that, you know, loosely speaking, the superactivation is that 0 plus 0 is bigger than 0. Okay, so this is what we proved in the asymptotic case. What Renyao Duan also managed to prove, also in the asymptotic case, which is something that you could loosely say is 1 plus 0 is bigger than 1, okay, which also is impossible for classical channels. And he proved this in the asymptotic case. Now, of course, that's an implication. That's an implication of our result. But what's really nice about Runyao's work is that he did this for the quantum zero error capacity as well. So this result holds of Runyao's holds for the quantum zero error capacity of channels. And it's an open question whether one can extend this really to this case, but for quantum zero error. Yes. You have to. So I had these two these local unit trees that I never fixed. In order to get the dimension of the symmetrized UPB not to blow up too much, one has to fix those unit trees to be something nice. So and that's where one has to fix the unit trees. Otherwise, you've got the danger that you blow up your UPB to the whole space, and then it's unextendable because there is no orthogonal complement. But that's no use. So that's where it doesn't work for all symmetrized UPBs. One has to pick the symmetries carefully to avoid the dimension blow up. Sure. Right.
On the other hand, you can get apparently some non-zero probability somewhere, specific non-zero probability, then it's conceivable that you can extract some quantitative information. Is that correct?
Yes. So I guess perhaps this is nicest to see in the context of the... So for zero error capacity, one, because it's defined with the error being equal to zero, you know, this is why, you know, we have these sort of qualitative, as you put them, results. I guess for this regularized Rényi entropy way of looking at these things, by this kind of continuity arguments, one actually gets, I think, okay, one has to check that this continuity works for the regularized Rényi entropies, which I'm not, off the top of my head, not 100% sure about. But one should maybe be able to get some region, so the Rényi P entropies close to zero should also be non-additive. And if one could extend this all the way up to one, then one would have proven the another very nice, well, a really nice result that's the major open question. So I think these continuity arguments should, and doing it quantitatively would give you a little bit, but it's never going to get you up to one. That will need different techniques.
Thank you.